That'll be...
I don't know what is your schedule, because I thought that you have to be back at 6:30.
And I'm going to talk briefly, because I would like to question.
Yes, like about 1 hour maximum?
Less. Less. After 45.
45 minutes. Okay. So, welcome, Michael Neymark. I think you have all received the information about this lecture today. We are very fortunate to have Michael here with us. He's this year's part of pre-Ars Electronica, and I think you have been already part of Ars Electronica jury for a few years, or a couple of times. Michael is a good friend. We met also many years ago already, and he used to work at Interval Research for many years, where he did very fantastic studies on interactivity and development of interactive systems. And recently, Michael, he's teaching at the University of
Southern California.
Together with Scott Fisher, I think. I think the people who participated in my class last semester know Michael Neymark's work already, and they also know about Scott Fisher. So it's very fantastic that we are privileged to see your latest work, which you just finished a couple of days ago, I heard.
Practically, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
So this is a completely fresh release, and we are probably one of the first people to see this.
This is true. Thank you, Krista. And normally, I'll stand up and pace until I get tired, if that's okay, because I've been sitting all day. Normally, what I would do in a situation like this is probably what most of your visiting artists do, and that's talk about their work and show their work and go back with their long history and whatnot. And that's what I normally do, but today I'm going to do something different, that I did a very rough pass in Vienna Monday night. So this might be a little bit awkward. I think I'll certainly go less than an hour, maybe more than 45 minutes, but please feel free to either ask questions during this presentation or at the end, hopefully, we can have a discussion. So here's a quote that I found in this wonderful book called Art at Science, edited by Kristen Laronde. If artists don't jump in and proactively help shape these powerful new tools, it will be left by default to advertisers, the military, organized religion, and sex peddlers. And on some levels, I have nothing really against advertisers, the military, organized religion, or sex peddlers, but I would feel very uncomfortable if they were the ones shaping these very powerful new communication and computer and network tools of tomorrow. So lately I've been thinking more than usual about artist interventions. And it's partly, frankly, because I'm in a relatively new program in a big old film school and pretty much was brought in to help and bring new initiatives in. More than do other things. So it seemed to me to be the most honest fit between my interest and what's good for the university. I have two observations about artist interventions. One is that I'm not sure that I would call artist interventions art. It certainly doesn't involve typically showing in galleries or festivals. And, you know, maybe it needs to be left to, you know, other people to make that call, but it's operating a little bit outside. You know, art making and tool making are different, related but different. The second observation is that, almost by definition, it requires dealing with non-artists. It's not hanging around with other artists, doing your work, sharing your work, showing your work. It's infiltrating somehow, is going in other communities and learning those communities, and if the goal is to do something successful. So what I thought I'd do is describe three personal case studies, and I'll warn you now, they're very, very uneven in terms of how much I'm going to talk about them and what I'm going to say and their metric for success. Okay. So, and again, I'll be a little awkward about this. So the idea of a consumer immersive viewer, consumer meaning they're in homes, which by definition means they're relatively cheap, and an immersive viewer meaning something that you either wear or hold up to your eyes and give you at least a visual, if not an audio-visual immersive experience. And one way to look at it that can get me excited is that 100 years ago, there was the stereoscope. And I hope you can see the picture well enough that you all recognize these things. They were extremely popular home parlor things, and there was an enormous business both for the stereoscopes and the software. And incredibly, the industry agreed early on the same format. So it was a very diverse, decentralized industry with many, many photographers, many, many printers, and many, many people making these things. 50 years ago, there was the ViewMaster, and in many respects the same. It was stereo. It, by the way, if you look at one and then look at the other, the ViewMaster is much worse. It's sort of a smaller image. But it has those discs you've probably all seen that hold, I don't know, 10 or 12 images. So there's a little bit of an improvement here insofar as you have, you know, multiple images and they're smaller. You know, you can get many. Unfortunately, it was a vertically integrated industry by ViewMaster, which controlled everything. And while the stereoscope was very landscape-oriented, the ViewMaster began with landscape and touristic sort of things and then gradually evolved into more very commercial things like Disney movie, you know, still frames and things like that. And it's still around. So it seems obvious that sometime soon, which we can discuss what that means, somebody or a group of people somewhere will invent the next generation that will have the same properties. It'll be immersive, it'll be cheap, it'll be in the home, it'll be kid-friendly. And Krista mentioned some of these people. It turns out that I can very definitively say that the group that I'm with at USC constitutes, even without me, humbly, an enormous experience group of people involved in VR 1.0, if you will. Mark Bull has co-founded Fake Space Labs. Scott Fisher made the first, I think you all know this, telepresence goggles at...
Maybe the art education people, maybe they don't need it, so
okay.
It's good if you mention it
okay.
Anyway.
Mm-hmm. At NASA, the American Space Agency, Perry Hoberman is a very talented artist that, you know, we've all shown together over the years, who's done a lot of stereoscopic work. Marian Tina is younger and recently graduated from the University of Illinois, Chicago, where the cave was invented. So a great deal of work on the cave and then me. So the question of if is off the table. It will happen. The question of how and when and who are really the only questions here. And I think that we could all agree on what this thing should be like. Again, we know that it would have to be small and relatively cheap. We could have lots and lots of discussions whether it's something that you hold up to your eyes or something that you wear, because most of the VR community would immediately say that I'm wrong and say that you should wear this. But if you look at history, it's not clear that that's the way it's going to go. So 2 years ago, we put together an initiative at USC to work with graduate business students and we had 7 second-year graduate business students helping us on how to do this. Oh, there's something else I forgot to say. No, I'll get to that in a moment. Okay, so the business people come in, and it was just hilarious because it's a different culture. There would be 5 or 6 of us on one side of the table, and the business people on the other side, and oh, the business people all come on time, and you know, we look at each other and go, God, that's amazing. You know, and over the course of one semester, it was a learning experience with them in terms of different ways of thinking. They're entirely market-oriented. So they went and did a great deal of market research and said it would have to be under $100. And we said, we can do that, but it has to have certain specifications of resolution. And it has to have sensors of some sort that when you look around, it updates. You know, if you're going to do it, it has to be done right. We even concluded that it should have little cameras in front of each eye because cameras cost nothing and they could help with the tracking, but they could also make this thing double as a stereoscopic camera or more incredibly you see what I see and I see what you see thing if we're both walking around with these things. And they also said, oh, and we said that if that's the case, we can do that for $100, but not for maybe 4 or 5 years. We could do it today, but it's going to cost you maybe $10,000. In quantities, maybe $1,000. And they also said it has to be good for 5-year-olds. And we thought that was really young, but they insisted that the educational entertainment market is a enormous market. So, here we are where our proposal was to look for funding to start building something that we knew could be affordable product in 4 or 5 years. And we fell into what I've heard since is called the Valley of Death. And what this means, and it's funny because I heard this when we were doing this for the first time, and the person described it to me as the Valley of Death. On one side are business people and venture capitalists and whatnot, and they say, I have a lot of money for a product, and you say, well, we have this killer product, and we could show them all the bar charts and everything that our business school generated, students generated. And at some point they'd say, when? And we'd say, 5 years, and they'd say, get out of here. It's just the wrong cycle. They think in terms of quarters or you know, quarter years or maybe 1 year. The people that do think about 4 or 5 years are, you know, foundations and government and whatnot, not the not-for-profit world. And if we were to say to them, we're doing this and there's going to be a lot of interesting academic and practical research questions that we're going to be addressing along the way, and there's gold at the end of this, they would say, making money? Get out of here. So it's kind of ironic because I would consider this as a case study dead. This is a failure. This is something that the work with the business school students was 1.5 years ago. Everybody says they love this project. Our dean, you know, everyone we talked with. And rather than looking, and you know, everyone's busy, we have other things to do, but rather than looking for other strategies, like building something poor to get business money to get it out sooner, or applying for very long-term grants, I would rather just tell you this because how many people have heard the phrase social enterprise? Okay, one. You don't count. So there's a lot of press in the United States. They don't really talk about the Valley of Death, but they talk about these non-profit, for-profit, hybrid things, and it's called social enterprise. So As far as I'm concerned, I would rather not budge on this because I do think it's a good business model, and wait it out. The second case study is called Movie Tagger, and I need to point out that like the consumer immersive viewer, this isn't me working alone, that this is in this case, even a more diverse group of people ranging from artists and designers, and Andreas Kratky co-authored the database cinema book with Lev Manovich, who's with us at USC. Very straightforward project. A method and system for parsing and richly tagging every movie ever made. Now, it's a simple, small project. Movie Tagger is conceived as an easy-to-use online system that allows a community of users to parse and add relevant keywords or tags to movies scene by scene, shot by shot, and frame by frame with a custom logging tool. The tags can be about performers, action, dialogue, cinematics, mood, environments, or anything else. They can be unlimited in number. This metadata, without any image or sound, is uploaded to a shared database where it can be used to rank, search, filter, and visualize tags through a unique graphical timeline interface. Now, so the way it would work is quite simple. We would develop a DVD video scrubbing tool. It might only work on laptops or PCs. Maybe only Macintoshes for the first rev, that allows you to stick in any DVD. We would prefer published movies. Stipulate an endpoint, stipulate an outpoint, and tag it, and it goes to our registry. If the endpoint is the first frame of the movie and the outpoint is the last frame of the movie, your tag is about the movie. If your endpoint and outpoint are the same, your tag is about a frame. And you know, by the way, that when you take a CD and you have iTunes or equivalent, and you stick your CD into your laptop and the playlist comes up, and you sort of assume that the playlist is on your CD because you stick it in and it comes up. That's not what's going on. Your iTunes knows what your CD is, and it goes to an online registry and downloads it. And it just feels like, therefore, it's on your CD. But imagine movies being tagged with millions and millions of tags. And we think that if we can make this tool and the service very easy and readily available, that essentially every movie ever made will be tagged in 2 months. I don't really believe that, but you get the idea. And the actual code to do this is not a lot. Why it's done and how it's displayed is a whole other questions, but this is another one that every time we mention this to somebody, they'll go, I'll do David Lynch movies, or, you know, I know every Volkswagen car crash in every movie, or whatever, and some people will want to tag a movie from beginning to end, and some people just are experts at scenes from a bunch of movies and will go in and tag them. And you may know the word folksonomy, which you can look on Wikipedia. Flickr, which I'll get to more regarding the third project, and Delicious have both championed the idea of non-hierarchical word databases. So rather than come up with this very strict hierarchy where some words are legal and some words are illegal, just let anybody do whatever they want and figure out ways to self-organize. To me, what's important about folksonomy is that the creativity is driving the technology, not the other way around. And that's, if there was one reason why I'm personally interested in artist interventions, that's what I think the arts community represents. Creativity, not driving technology. So this project is in process. We haven't patented anything or anything like that, and because this is coming out of the oldest and most prominent cinema school in the country, part of our pitch for potential funders, and it's included. Do you have Netflix here? We don't have Netflix here. Okay, these video, you know, movie distribution companies, is that we can use our cinema school community of faculty and students as a test bed so that we can learn how to do it quite quickly. So this case study is pending. The third project is something that I got a little bit of funding for almost 2 years ago internally at USC to think about how can the photo mapping process be democratized more than it is. And it's funny because this was a year before Google Street View happened, and you probably all are a little familiar with Google having right now scores of camera cars. They've hit Europe last week or 2 weeks ago, going up and down every single street. And this is something that I actually have probably more experience than anybody else in. And I don't think it's a bad idea, but there's a huge difference between doing lab work and doing field work. And it means dealing with a community and engaging and being sensitive to a community. And as I was doing research 2 summers ago, the piece that excited me the most was how can everyday people's photographs be placed in a 3D world model like Google Earth, not just so they look like playing cards, but so that they are seamlessly integrated as part of the 3D model. And came up with a way and met with the head of Google Earth the end of 2 summers ago, and he said, you know, write up a couple pages, and we sometimes fund stuff like this. A year went by, nothing, and then they threw a little bit of money our way. So what I'd like to do now is spend maybe 30 minutes, because this one we hit, you know, we did okay with this. We ended up with about 5 months of funding for 8 people to run as hard and fast and efficiently as we can to make something as an intervention. I mean, we weren't going to save the world, we weren't going to change Google or its competitors, but what could we do to maximize impact? And what we decided to do was as much research as we could, a video, and we did patent everything insofar as we posted everything online. You'll see the URL at the end of this. So we decided to use the patent system in a funny way as it was originally intended for. That is to say, we're going to share everything that we learned publicly. We're just going to post it all out there. And if some entity commercially wants to use any of this, they need to know that we've protected what we've done. Somebody non-commercially wants to use it, I don't care. So, I gave this presentation a week ago Monday at Google. So I'm going to so just imagine that I'm pitching to Google. Actually, I have to take this off because I was casual.
We are all business people.
So. Right. So, you know, this whole thing was entirely sort of tuned to, it's like fishing, you know, like putting, you know, like bait on a line. And this is the homepage to the website. We got some nice press when we launched it with the New York Times and with Boing Boing. Viewfinder is a novel method for users to spatially situate or find the pose of their photographs and then to view these photographs along with others as perfectly aligned overlays in a 3D world model such as Google Earth. Our objective is to provide a straightforward procedure for geolocating photos of any kind, that's important, and our approach is to engage a community of users for a certain amount of human help, that's also important. We specify that a 10-year-old should be able to find the pose of a photo in less than a minute. We're convinced it's possible. This is our progress report. So I'm going to go very, very quickly. At Google, some of this stuff is going to be technical, but I just want you to sort of get the experience of what something like this was like. And if you're really interested, you can find it online. Half of us were designer, artist, filmmakers, the bottom half, and half of us were computer scientists and computer vision people. And right there, as an artist intervention, we had to have pizza lunches every Friday, and it took maybe 3 months before there was even enough agreement on values. For example, computer scientists and vision people tend to want to automate everything. They say, we have an algorithm that can do this, we have an algorithm that can do that, and we say, great, we want to use it, but if that restricts creativity or the type of imagery, that's more important that that doesn't happen. That's something later. Okay, this you just read. This is an example, but we'll get to later. So, this is an image taken early on by my colleague Will Carter, and the background is Google Earth. That the background fuzzy image came from a satellite or a high-flying airplane and is part of the world model. And the little photo inserted is Will walking through this bank parking lot in LA and looking down and taking a picture of his foot. And I don't know why I find this absolutely incredible. The fact that it's lined up and that he did it, but more importantly, that he thought of doing it. This picture is useless to everyone except Will. And that's what we're getting at. I used to ask audiences, how many of you have thought about what's going to happen to you after you die and decided that I'm burial and nowhere, and I'll spare you doing this, but I was obsessed with this question, and typically some percentage of hands fly up because it's a yes or no answer that almost everyone knows. And this is just, and then there's a statistic that goes something like this. Before 150 years ago, 8% of everybody on the planet never went more than 50 kilometers from their home in their entire lifetime. So this is to say that place runs deep. And part of the magic of using media to depict this, one of my favorite at least, is what's called re-photography. There's an entry in Wikipedia, and unlike the pictures up here, it's really magic when they're registered. So at the bottom, third view, is a group that's been doing stuff like this. So there's a community of people that find historic photos, figure out the lens, the location, and the angle, and it has to be registered, otherwise the magic isn't there. There's something about the registration that makes it magic. And if you think, they're going into Photoshop and they're doing distorted perspective and stuff like that, if you've heard these guys speak, they don't know computer vision, they wear hiking boots all the time. You know, they're not that kind of culture. They really are obsessed with developing the intuition to do stuff like this.
Sorry, Doctor. What do they do exactly?
What they do is they take a historical photo and they replicate what's called the pose of the camera. They replicate exactly where the camera's position, angle, and field of view was. Right. And it's obvious when you get it right, and the proof is that you can dissolve from one to the other, and the only change is time. So another example that's really the same phenomena is and actually an old installation of mine that involves filming a living room set with a panning camera and then replacing the camera with a projector. Same position, same angle, same lens, and painting the entire room white to make a screen out of it. And if you look carefully, you see that it's not perfect. But it's, you know, it fades in and out. And that the people are not painted white. So this piece was not about replicating reality as much as about, it's called displacements, showing what these artifacts are all about. But again, there's something magic about projecting a spinning dome on a white painted dome, a globe. And if it's off too much, it simply doesn't work. Without splitting hairs, what it takes is getting the X, Y, and Z right, the pan, tilt, and rotation right, and the fields of view right. And again, Google audience, if you think you're going to have GPS and the camera and whatnot, it's helpful, but it's not helpful enough. And there are tools and technologies that are very, very expensive in the Hollywood special effects technology industry that are much more accurate, because the girl spinning the globe, if it's an art piece, if it's off a little, the photo in the parking lot, if it's off a little, it's okay. If you're making Spider-Man 4, it can't be off at all. What we need is something kind of between the two. And humans are particularly good at doing this kind of alignment, so that's been our approach. Witness point tracking is an early example where, for the movie Close Encounters, a bunch of light bulbs, essentially, spherical bulbs, were placed in the scene at known locations to each other. The camera was freely moved. These points were used by hand to figure out the pose of the camera, where the camera was, and then hand taken out. They almost got the contract for Close Encounters, but they didn't. This is Street View. Before I even show it, let me just say that this class of stuff like Street View, and you know, Street View came out in the U.S. a little more than a year ago. Camera cars going down every street in town, panoramic camera on top, a means of taking a photograph every common interval, whether it's 2 meters or 5 meters, but it has to be the same, and then sort of putting it on a map. And it's important to remember that this is not a 3D model. It's critical. It's just a bunch of images. And it can look a little bit like a 3D model if you do something clever to go from one to the other. In the case of Google Street View, they do a combination of dissolve and zoom of the one. You can see what's going on here. But if you ask yourself a simple question, do any of the in-between frames look credible? The answer is no. I mean, this is eye candy, and there's nothing wrong with it, but it's not like you can take a midway frame and it's as photographic as anything else. Here's a more impressive example of one of their competitors. Wow, that's cool, huh? And obviously some image processing is going on that has something to do with, I don't know. I assume making assumptions about the ground plane. And does it look better? Well, yeah, it does. But are any of the images in between, you know, credible, usable images? No. Photosynth, how many people have heard of Photosynth? Quarter, okay. So maybe luckily for us, shortly after we started work on our project, Photosynth was announced, this is about a year and a half ago, by Microsoft and University of Washington, and the dream, if you look at the bottom, is to take all the world's photos and use computer magic to extract something like a model. It's called a point cloud, and to have the pictures all more or less spatialized, similar to what we're doing, in this model. And again, it's important to point out that it's not a model, it's a bunch of dots, so there's no geometric or meaning underneath it, and that to go from one photo to the other still has the problem that I just showed you in terms of in-betweens. What they have now is really impressive, and you can Google it and find YouTube demos, and they've done a great job in design. And their vision, we definitely share about, you know, taking the world's photographs and integrating them into some 3D whole. But the problem, if you read their paper carefully, and I'll spare you all the details, is being computer scientists, they're proud about no hands and automating everything. So when they took images from Flickr by searching Notre Dame in Paris, they got 2,635 photos matching that. When they pushed them through their system, they could use 597. And the other statistics add up to about 22%. The 22% that did make it through, of course, are the ones that all look most alike and have no people in front and things like that. And if I were to go out and shoot, I could use that and do something, I'm sure, very powerful. But again, it's technology telling the creativity what to do. Panoramio is a geotag photo sharing service similar to Flickr that was acquired by Google less than a year ago. And it allows you to place your photos, but flat, not what we want to do. And you can put whatever photos you want on, but they have a submission policy to put them on Google Earth. When you go to Google Earth right now, you can click a little so-called layer, Panoramio, and all these little blue dots, 4.5 million, come up. And it turns out that what Microsoft Photosynth does, because of technological limitations, Google Panoramio does by editorial policy. So if you read, non-selected photos in Google Earth include people, portraits, persons, cars, planes, machines, pets, animals, flowers, close-ups, events, and so on. And again, I'll just read this very quickly, that July 2007, they had 1.2 million photos selected in Google Earth, and last February, 5 months later, they had 4.5 million. Now, they're doing this by hand. Somebody or some group of people is going through and applying that editorial policy. I mean, there's no other way they could be doing it. Meanwhile, so there are 4.5 million of these flat little Flickr-like pictures today in Google Earth. There are these high-octane pictures, these gigapixel images, maybe 200 or 300 currently in Google Earth. And when you look at them, they look like this. That's aligned. I mean, that's not, it can't be a coincidence the way things line up, the shoreline and the horizon and whatnot. And especially if you go out of it, it's clear that this picture is posed. I found this on Internet Archive. This is the first homepage of Flickr in, I think, 2004. Isn't it cute? And a few months later, on the Flickr blog, Katarina, one of the co-founders, wrote that here are some lovely new tags that she found, like frog, 3 months after Flickr started. When you search the keyword frog today on Flickr, you get over 100,000 hits. Something very cool is going on here. And Flickr has more than 2 billion images. And I would argue that it's precisely this folksonomy approach to tags and the fact that any and all images are fine, you know, really nasty stuff the community will filter out, is what makes Flickr, of these three things, Photosynth, Panoramio, and Flickr, the only one of the three where it's much more creativity-driving technology than the other way around, hence the artist intervention. So today, Google Earth has posed several hundred of those high-octane photos, and Google Earth then has 4.5 million, which they haven't posed. Photosynth has an impressive way to automatically combine sets of photos with no underlying 3D model, and more importantly, most arbitrary photos are thrown away. And Flickr does something right by tapping a community and having an enormous free-for-all database, but there's no 3D model or world model involved. Our approach is that it has to be any and all photos, that a little bit of human help can go a long way. And we're not proposing that humans should have to do stupid, boring things like matching points in the future, and that someday cameras will be able to have better, cheaper sensors, and computer vision algorithms will be able to do this eventually automatically. But we're not there yet, and the idea of something like this as a getting from here to there strategy seems reasonable. I'm not going to go into all the detail here, except to say that we came up with two approaches, and again, this is the technical warning part. Both approaches have the same step one. It's where you upload your image. You have a system where you can use Google Map or Google Earth to say, I took it here and point in a general direction. And the easier of the two solutions is once you've nailed down the XYZ, it turns out that the other parameters of pan, tilt, rotation, and field of view against a model are something that you all could do. It's a very easy thing to do, either by moving the image around or locking down a couple points. The problem with this approach is that initial, I took the picture here and assumptions about the height are absolute. And if you were off in your initial position, it's not going to work and you're going to have to go back to step one. Step two is a more sophisticated approach where you have you're comparing points between your picture and points in the 3D model. And this is a more computer vision. We've done some early tests in it. But more importantly, this requires that we have the depth data from people like Google Earth, which is currently not available. There's probably one more, but I don't want to lose the slide. And again, this is a little bit technical, but the second approach, the 2D to 3D approach, is by far, sort of more interesting. It would be the 10-year-old would upload her picture, his picture, put a spot on a map, next to it get a rough approximation from Google Earth of where it was, and go through this very simple procedure of this point is this point, this point is this point, and it would just self-align until it says, good, you're done. But that's going to take a little bit of work. And again, I don't want to get into much of this, but that's all about finding the pose of your picture. The question of how you view it in a model, that image that you saw that I said was aligned, and then we came out and we saw it, and it was a flat photograph in Google Earth. If you stand in the right place, it's aligned. If you stand in that right place, it doesn't matter whether that photo is close and small to your point of view or far and larger. And there are other issues like whether these are just design variables, like how much transparency you have and whether you show the frame or not. And what's interesting about these is that there probably isn't any one right answer, but it's a design question. And what that means is that a lot of people have to go in and start playing with this just to see what works and what doesn't. Since I'm going to show you a video in a minute, I want you to keep an eye out for when the posed image fades up versus is already there, whether there's a frame visible before or after and things like that, because we varied a little just to show. So this step one that's common for both approaches, we developed a very simple interface where you upload your picture, top left. You move around Google Maps, and it's making an assumption about the ground level, and what you're trying to do is get the image on the right, which is a screen grab from Google Earth, to as best match your image. And once you do that, it's relatively straightforward to do the other parameters aligning. By the way, you all know how difficult it is to tell the difference between moving forward and backward and zooming. or between moving left and right and panning, this isolates the two, so it turns a very difficult problem by making it a two-step process into an easy problem to sort of pose like this. And the other approach, this is a very early proof of concept, where you're matching points, and you know, this kind of looks easy, but actually what's going on here is a lot of computational energy, where every time he matches a point, the system goes through 500 iterations looking for the best fit for the rest of the model. And I think I said all of this, and you know, it's again the last point, especially to a community like Google, that if I had 5 seconds to give my message about why I'm here, it's this one, that you have to have the community involved. And again, if you're going to be driving camera cars up and down the street and satellite photos, and the community isn't involved, you're asking for trouble, and you're cutting off lots of creativity. Okay, so the video is 5 minutes, and then questions. So again, made for Google, made for Microsoft, made for Yahoo. Do we have audio? Thanks. Yeah, thank you. No, this is so lame. There we go. Thanks. Okay. Good. And I don't know whether you like the music or not, but you know, we did it for the Google community. So the basic idea, of course, was to look at what Photosynth can't do and Panoramio policy won't do and violate every one of them. It's a historical photograph. This is Amsterdam. This is posing a photograph against the shoebox environments that's prominent many places right now. Thank you. This is around the LA County Museum of Art. Oh, this one coming up is from the box office failure, Miracle Mile, a favorite art student. These are images from Google Street View that we just took, and pieces of the panorama. From the movie North by Northwest. Wilco album cover, if you know Wilco. This is Dealey Plaza, where John F. Kennedy was assassinated, and the second image is actually from Second Life. So, obviously, we've been using Google Earth a lot, and I gotta say that when I lie down at night, if I want to visualize myself leaving my body and flying up, even if I'm in a different city or astral project, I can do that in ways that I never could before using Google Earth. And Google Earth is this kind of interesting tool that you fly around enough, that the degree of vividness that I can do this has changed my consciousness in a weird way. And on a less cosmic level, Flickr has changed mine and obviously many other people's consciousness by the fact that you can search things like cats in sinks. And these, you know, you can always find pictures for anything. So, you know, on a more serious note, the idea here was both to somehow integrate the two and to do it in a way where what I want to see come out of this, if it ever gets out, is a surprise. I want to see stuff that is unimaginable because it's maximally open to the creative community. Questions?
Two shots have been taken in the same place. Which one are you choosing?
Yeah, and what if a million shots are all taken around Notre Dame Cathedral?
Right.
Lucky for us, that's a problem that everybody has to deal with today. Whether it's Panoramio or Flickr, when you search anything, and you know, the general answer has to be filtering. And you know, it's funny because I've taken this intentionally, almost religious approach that the posed photos should only be seen from the proper point, and every other point, even if it's a little, is a form of distortion. And I've argued with Perry Hoberman and very talented artists about this, because as I showed with Street View and others, whenever you're going from one picture to the other, there's going to be some sort of in-betweens that mostly probably won't work. But if you had millions and millions and billions of pictures, it's a little bit of a different story. You should be able to go down the Champs-Élysées on a winter morning, right? And that's a long, long way off, but these are difficult questions, and that's a good question. That's the best non-answer I can give. How would you do it? Right.
Or you could make it by depth. So
yep.
Actually, you could select things by order arrival or submission, something like that. Actually.
Yeah.
So that's because you know when this has been submitted. You could do a sort of timeline.
Has anybody seen Google Earth in the past week? Anybody? How many of you have seen Google Earth? Okay, almost all of you. Check it out. Download the new version that came out last week. They've added to many metropolitan areas the geometry of the buildings, what we call shoeboxes. All of Japan they've had because it's urban data, for example. The new version has, for many urban areas, the aerial photographs just on the buildings, because most of the photographs now are coming from enough of an angle. And it's like 90% of the time wrong, and it looks a little bit disturbing. So Google has a major problem right now of dealing with photographs on models. The Viewfinder project has very intentionally avoided the topic of modeling. That we've... partly because, you know, we didn't have all the money and all the time. We wanted to bite off a very specific little piece of a larger puzzle. So our project assumes that there's a model, and it's off, no matter how good, and it's all about taking your photograph and posing it properly. But we know that there's an enormous pressure right now for, if you have photographs, somehow using them to enhance the model. So that's another solution, where even though I'm talking about respecting the integrity of photographs and making it flicker-like, where something like this might end up being used just to make the models better. Yes?
A naive question, but this is works for outdoor situations. Or would that also work for indoor situations? Let's say we take a picture now of this situation here. Would
yep.
there be a kind of future scenario where those images could be removed?
Well, I hope there will be a future scenario of how those pictures are integrated, and if we think it through together for a moment, there are lots of implications about that. One is, so you're flying around Google Earth, and you can get in front of that window, and somehow you can see what your pictures are through that window when you come in. I can tell you right now that the people at Google and Microsoft aren't even thinking along those lines. The second movie map I showed you, Everyscape, a competitor to Street View actually is, and they, if you go to their website, they have examples of exactly that, using that long, swooshy sort of thing to go from the sidewalk through a window and into an image. Even if your image was put there by you, there are some cultural image implications about privacy. I mean, even if you put that image there, let's say it was here, and let's say 10 years from now this building is bought by Microsoft. The college disappears and these are all offices and, you know, it's Microsoft Corporation. And on Google Earth is a public image of you in this building. Who's in control now? So there's a technical answer and there's a cultural answer, and I think they're both challenging. And it's not a naive question at all. Yes?
Political question. You have two images in. One was lying, spying, stepped down, and the other one was stopped the Iraq war. And I was surprised that you presented such a video at Google, so you must be pretty sure what kind of political position they are taking.
You know, Google is a funny place, because I would bet that 90-some percent of the people there are Democrats. They're all filthy, rich little shits right now. I mean, it's incredible how much money, you know.
We take everything with you. Oh, boy, we found it. It's okay.
Well, I mean, you know, everybody knows what's going on with Google right now, and it's an extraordinary situation. If you heard the news, I think, yesterday, Google is the number one recognized brand in the world today, more than Coca-Cola, Disney, Sony. So, no, I have no problem, you know.
Yeah, but it's an explicit statement. I'm more surprised about it.
We wanted to make an explicit statement, not because we thought the audience would agree with us, but because that's what makes Flickr vital. That is so important. And again, it's about who's in control here with creativity.
Yeah, it's about community.
Right. And again, we wanted to look at their policy and look at what the technological limitations are and show as wide a variety of exceptions as we possibly could. But you know, the United States is so weird right now for a whole bunch of reasons that I don't think there's anything problematic about doing stuff like that at a company like Google, or trashing Google for that matter. Yes?
Can I ask your personal motivation for this project, or was it, why did you adapt the pictures of the world?
Yeah. Yeah, again, if this was a normal artist presentation, I would show you 25 years worth of work with what I fancy myself as calling place representation. And my story in 30 seconds is that I began with a fascination for representing place on maybe a naive and technical basis, making it look more real. And the more places that I did, mostly as art installations, and the more places I went to, gradually over many long period of time, the appreciation that you can't separate place from the politics and culture of place, that they're inseparable, and that's been driving my passion more than anything else. So you have the technological community trying to make it look as real as possible, and then if you look at the state of the world, well, again, place runs deep, and that's sort of where my work began. And now, as mapping and 3D earth modeling are becoming doable, I feel a certain compulsion to voice a certain point of view. Does that help?
But I think, Michael, I think you're being too modest. I think on a kind of historic level, we can say that Street Finder, in a way, must be a kind of product or in the same line of thinking that Aspen Movement was doing. And I think most people maybe, or not everybody knows.
Yeah,
could
okay.
you show this on your website, just briefly?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, could I show it on my no, I can't because I'm not online right now. I can be. Is it Wi-Fi?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
This is another question because we had Artin Tom, Joachim Salter, a few days ago.
Right.
And I think it's quite really interesting to see how these early examples of interactive media have now led to this really large scale multi-billion dollar business.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think that's definitely, I think there's a very strong connection between those early movie maps that we did, or even the Karlsruhe movie map.
Yeah, you know, because I have to leave in about 15 minutes, I'd rather just give you the point. It's namark.net, and there's a lot of stuff. Well, okay, I'll give you a tease. That if you go to projects, and if you, there are a bunch of things going back from an early, are we good there? Yeah, good enough. Project in Aspen, Colorado. You don't want to know how many years ago.
This was 84, no?
No, earlier. A project done for the Paris Metro, camera car, me, an aerial version using a helicopter camera to fly a grid over San Francisco. We're at least up to the 80s now, you know. Early 90s, a similar thing in Karlsruhe with a camera mounted on a tram car. And actually, this is probably as good, if I'm going to give a teaser, is you can't do stuff like this without having to actually deal with real community people. And if you deal with real community people, you know, unless you're insensitive, actually, I like it. It has nothing to do with being insensitive or not. I enjoy meeting people, interacting with people different from me. And you can't make stuff like this without dealing with people different from you.
Maybe a more polemic question. Do you regret that you didn't patent those ideas back then when you did those as the movie maps and the... not the displacements, couldn't be patented, but the movie maps?
I don't know.
Now you would be probably a zillionaire.
I'm not sure it actually works that way because the patent situation has changed so much. You know, actually, you're probably right enough that if I would have totally obsessed with lawyers 20 years ago and just held on to them as hard as I could, but then I probably wouldn't have continued to do this artwork. I would have, you know, been different. I agree, you know, Chris and I both gave little presentations a couple days ago in Vienna, so your point of view about protection, I think, is a legitimate one, and the only insight I have into this is if the patent process does not eat you alive, I think it's healthy for artists to engage. And for example, in the United States, there's a thing called a provisional patent application that's English. You don't need a lawyer, and it costs $100, and it holds your position for a year. So, our entire website, the Viewfinder website, we applied for a provisional patent application several days before it went public. So, you know, when you think about what this means, I feel really good about this approach. And there's a link on the Viewfinder website, patents, and you can read exactly what I'm going to say. All the words here, we filed a provisional patent application. One of the cool things about doing that is that you can read everything we've done. We're holding back nothing, no secrets. But if there's anything here that you want to commercialize, guess what? We're protected. And lucky for us, if Google isn't interested, Microsoft might be. So this was an approach that didn't derail anything from what we were doing. I kept the lawyers away, actually, because they wanted to go and say, we can make it better. No, we just want to take our honest stuff. We don't want to compromise academic or artistic integrity. And maybe we're not going to get everything that we could have, but, you know, I'd settle for 75% of $1 billion. I'd settle for 1% of $1 billion. You know, and I think that's an approach that's a healthy one for the artist community.
Is there something similar in Europe, in Austria, around provisional patent approach application?
Yeah. Yes, actually here this university is now linked to the Uni Invents program. So if people here make good inventions, they can patent it, and the university will pay it. It happened.
And you know, the funny thing about this is that a lot of you, you know, just knowing Christian Laurent for many years, might be just doing your own artwork and having some little problem that, or some hacking that you're doing that you're trying to solve. And there might be a team of researchers at Sony or Microsoft or Apple or Electronic Arts throwing tens of millions of dollars on the same problem. And whoever here is working on that and this team at a large corporation not only have no idea about the existence of each other, but there's no means by which they could even find each other. That's weird. Is that a weird enough note to end on?
But how? What can we do about this? What would you suggest that artists or creatives do about this?
This business of the ideal scenario for me is if the Microsoft research team Googles a few of their keywords and more stuff comes up and they look at it, number one, because you've made it public, and they go, this stuff is relevant, then that missing piece is number two, that you're protected. It's the right combination, and maybe I'm being idealistic, but that to me is a positive model of what could happen in the next short term, 1 or 2 or 3 years.
I think your time is very short, but if there's one last question.
I'll stop in meditation. I find it's good to look at videos because most of the devices are also things
that. Well, we fantasize about it to the extent that you may have seen there was, where I put a camera on a tripod and shot three. What's interesting technically about video is that even today, where a little bit of human help might be required to find the posts of an image, because with video, each progressive image is so much like the previous image that computers can really, if you find the first one and you're doing a complicated move, it should be able to just automatically do it. So you can email Google and say, we really like this viewfinder project, and video would be great if you had it.
Fantastic. If you could follow, it would be basically within the Google.
Absolutely.
And it drives Google essentially to move.
Totally.
And then you cross another movie and you it's all on that. Right. That's fantastic.
Actually, okay, this is a good thing to end on.
Right?
No, Laurent brought up something that maybe is the single most profound thing that I forgot, so thank you. The difference between Earth 3D models and fictitious 3D models like Second Life and Warcraft is that for every position and time, there is an absolute truism about planet Earth. And without getting into postmodernist rhetoric, the fact is, I know people that would disagree with this. Several people in the same place at the same time aiming cameras at the same event will capture the same thing. They might have drastically different perceptions about it. So what that means is that unlike World of Warcraft and Second Life, all of these currently competing 3D Earth models and photographic databases can be aggregated into this enormous Earth model over time. And that's a pretty serious proposition when you think that everything can be in a common database because of the placeness of planet Earth, the fact that stuff doesn't swish around. And that to me is a very big idea. I think that's a challenge that's worth, contemplation and more intervention. Thank you all for staying with us so long.
Signing the paper that is circulated at the
Two questions.
I don't know.
I have to the street and the city where you live, and then I can.